introduce our first book. So let's give them a hand. And our first speaker this morning is somebody who'll need no introduction to most of you, Uriah Kriegel from philosophy at Sydney University in Arizona, who's going to be speaking to us on the dispensability of intentional objects. Welcome, Uriah.
Thank you, Hugh, and thanks, Luca, for organizing the conference. What I want to talk about are three things. First, I'll try to zoom in from the topic of the conference to the topic of my talk. Then I'll present a positive position about the topic of my talk and then defend this position against three objections. So the topic of the conference is ontological commitment. And there are two kinds of questions I think you can ask with respect to ontological commitment. One is the first order question, which things should we be ontologically committed to? Or which putative entities should we accept as genuine entities or genuinely accept as entities? Accept genuinely as entities. That's something like, what should we be ontologically committed to? Second order question is, what are we doing when we're ontologically committing to something? What is involved in being ontologically committed to something? What is it for us to be ontologically committed to something? And I think one way to think of it is that the first order question is about the extension of exists or is treated just for the sake of exposition as a predicate. And the second order question asks about the intention of exists or is. We might say that the first order question is the subject matter of ontology, and the second order question is the subject matter of meta-ontology. That will be a bit like ethics and meta-ethics. Ethics asks which things are good. Meta-ethics asks what is it for something to be good? What's involved in, when we're saying that something is good, what is it that we're saying about it? And likewise, meta-ontology says, what is it what we're saying about something when we're ontologically committing to it? Or we say that it exists or is. So the topic of the conference, I think, probably there will be talks about both kinds of questions. But when I hear ontological commitment, I think of a conference that's dedicated to the second order question, what is ontological commitment? What is it to ontologically commit to something? That's the topic. But I'll be talking actually about the first order question, particular issue with respect to whether some kinds of putative entities really do exist. My excuse for doing that is that the question I'll be asking, the particular issue that I'll be tackling, is the most general that you can have within that first order question. So what do I mean by the most general? Here are some putative entities that you have all kinds of ontological controversies around. Mathematical entities, moral properties, possibilia, time. This is not a comprehensive list. There will be a bunch of others. Of course, as we all know in philosophy, there's always, even for the most obvious entities that we should accept, there's someone who says, no, these are not real entities. So when I think what is most obvious to me that we should accept in our ontology, I think of people, cars, houses, trees, tables. But you have a lot of philosophers, or you have some philosophers at least, like Peter van Inwagen will claim that cars and houses and tables don't really exist. Other philosophers will say that even, you know, trees or snails, if snails are unconscious, don't exist, like Trenton Merricks holds this. Other people will claim that there are no macrophysical objects at all, even people don't exist. You only have subatomic particles in the world. That's Gideon Rosen's view. And you could have some people who deny that even microphysical objects exist, that neither macrophysical nor microphysical objects exist. Some gunk theorists might hold this, and some monists, Terry Horgan, I think, is committed to saying that there are neither people nor subatomic particles. There's only one thing, really, the biggest thing. And so these are... These are objects that have been denied, whose existence has been denied by some philosophers, but it's not mainstream to debate whether these things exist. They seem to, it's better thought of as a challenge to ontology, but most people accept that they exist. And notice that these are all concrete particulars. The putative entities that I mentioned as producing the biggest controversies are usually not concrete particulars. So these are entities that no philosopher, or very few philosophers, feel very certain that they either exist or not, don't exist. Mathematical entities, moral properties, possibilia, time. Well, maybe time is a concrete particular. I guess that's intelligible. But who knows what time is? Well, some people might know it. I shouldn't be punking time in a conference sponsored by the Center for Time. That's a sentence you've never heard before. So, what I want to add to this list is the category of intentional objects, construed as a category that includes also merely intentional objects. So an intentional object, for the purposes of our talk, can be defined as an object of thought. An intentional object is an object of thought. So I'm thinking about Vienna. Vienna is the object of my thought, so Vienna is an intentional object. But it's not merely an intentional object, because it's also an object in some other senses. Merely intentional objects are things that are objects of thought, but are not objects in any other sense. So Sherlock Holmes would be an example. You can think of Sherlock Holmes. But if Sherlock Holmes is an object, it's only in virtue of being an object of thought. Now, why do I say that this is the most general kind of question you can ask in this area? Because notice that mathematical entities, moral properties, possibilia, time, artifacts, all these are very different kinds of putative entities. But they all have one thing in common, at least, is that they're all things that we can contemplate. They're all contemplatables. Contemplatables? Are there rules about this? They are thinkables. They are things that you can think about. So they are intentional objects, perhaps merely intentional objects, but in fact, you might think that if something is not thinkable, it cannot even be subject to a controversy in ontology. So in a way, to get into the game of ontological commitment, you need to be a thinkable. You need to be an intentional object. Once you got into the game, maybe you'll win and you'll be on the list of the things that we should accept. Maybe you'll lose and you'll drop out. But to get into the game, you need to be an intentional object. An intentional object is what all these things have in common. So if you had an argument that you should accept merely intentional objects, you will have produced in one fell swoop an argument for all these controversial entities to accept them into your ontology. You may have to change a little bit your preconceptions on what kind of entity these entities are, but you will accept them as existing. So in that sense, the category of intentional objects is the highest ontological category. We might say it's the category that is not a subcategory of any other ontological category. I don't know if this is a definitional or it's a substantive claim about the category of intentional objects, but in any case, it's the category which is not a subcategory of any other ontological category. In that sense, it's the highest ontological category. Another way to think of it is to say that the predicate is an intentional object, cannot function as a sortal. It will not divide putative entities into two subgroups, those that are intentional objects and those that aren't. Because everything, to get into the game, like I said, you have to be an intentional object. We don't know what's on the other side of is an intentional, what drops outside is an intentional object. We cannot even contemplate it, and that's true here. So that's the first part of the talk, just to focus on what I'll talk about. Merely intentional objects is the highest ontological category And if, like I said, if we have an argument for merely, merely intentional objects, then we will have an argument for all these other problematic entities. Notice that the converse doesn't hold. If we have an argument against merely merely intentional objects, we don't thereby have an argument against, let's say, mathematical entities. It doesn't show that there aren't mathematical entities if there aren't merely intentional objects. It only shows that if there are mathematical objects, it's not because they are thinkable. Now, what I want to argue in this part of the talk, the second part, is that there aren't merely intentional objects. We shouldn't accept them in our ontology. Now, I think as far as the phenomena are concerned, there's no real pressure to suppose that they are entities, that we should accept merely intentional objects in our ontology. The only thing that pressures us towards accepting them as entities is philosophical doctrine, not anything about the phenomena. So what do I call the phenomena here? So there's a phenomenon. You look at a tree, you see a tree. You have a visual experience of a tree. The intentional object of your experience here, what is it? Well, I think it's pretty simple. It's a tree. It's the tree that you're seeing. Some people ask, what is the status of intentional objects? What kind of entities are they? Well, it's pretty simple. The status of this intentional object is that it's a tree. It's a tree. That's the status. There's nothing deeper to say here. But yeah, maybe this is the easy case. What about the difficult case where you hallucinate a tree? And maybe your hallucination is phenomenologically indistinguishable from a visual experience, a veridical visual experience of a tree. And so there's no tree, but you have the same intentional state. Then what's the intentional object there? I think as far as phenomena are concerned, again, it's pretty simple. The answer is that there is no intentional object in this case. What's the status of the intentional object? It doesn't have a status. There's nothing that has to have a status. There's nothing that calls for a status, that requires a status. That's the phenomena. But there are philosophical pressures to say something different, that there is something here, maybe not an external, physical, spatiotemporal tree, but something. We can think of it as a kind of an argument that goes like this. If X is a tree seeing, then there is a Y such that Y is the intentional object of X. Two, tree seeings and tree hallucinations belong to the same intentional kind. So they are intentionally type identical. Three, intentional acts that belong to the same intentional kind have the same kind of intentional object. So intentionally type identical acts should have type identical objects. And therefore, four, if X is a tree hallucination, then there is a Y such that Y is the intentional object of X. So that's some kind of argument to get you to say that even in the case of hallucinations, there is an intentional object. And of course, once you say that, then you have the whole can of worms of figuring out what kind of thing can be a value of this variable Y. What kind of thing is a hallucinatum? Is that a word? So some people say it's abstracta. There isn't a physical spatiotemporal tree, but there is the idea of a tree, the concept of a tree, an abstract entity somewhere outside space and time. Now, when you have a hallucination of a tree, you're connecting to that entity. That's what's happening. You're related to that entity. That's the intentional object of your hallucination. Other people, like sense datum theorists and Brentano and Frank Jackson at some point, argue that they are mental concreta. So they're not abstract entities, they're concrete entities, but they exist only in your mind. There's a sort of a tree image that happens, that exists only inside your mind, and that's what you're related to when you hallucinate. Other people, like Meinung and more recently Graham Priest, claim it's non-existent object. Other people claim it's possibilia. All of these are very problematic for a variety of reasons. Yeah, there are ontological reasons. These are all weird entities, right? And there are also epistemological problems. We're all familiar, in the case of the mental concreta, we're all familiar with the claim that there is a veil of appearances that would be thrown over the physical external world if what you're connected to invariably is a mental concretum. But the same thing really can be said about the other, and so at least abstracta. You could say if you're connected primarily to abstracta, then this will throw a veil of abstracta over the world of concreta. So this is a can of worms, like I said, and I think it's better to avoid having to say any of these things and instead deny that hallucinations have an intentional object. So how will we deny this? We have to basically deny one of the premises of this argument, and I say let's leave the phenomena alone and just revisit the philosophical doctrines that lead us to suppose that maybe there are things that are being hallucinated. So the philosophical doctrines are premises 2 and 3. Second premise says that tree seeings and tree hallucinations are the same kind of intentional state, same kind of intentional object, intentional act. Or at least they could be under some conditions. And this is denied by some people, right? Disjunctivists, at least in one way to understand what disjunctivism means, argue precisely that a hallucination and a seeing of a tree are not type identical intentional states. I think that disjunctivism is nuts. Now, I realize that's not an argument, but it felt good saying it. So I think it's nuts, and so I'll go with 3. I'll deny that intentional acts that belong to the same intentional kind have the same kind of intentional object. Will basically suggest that sometimes you have intentional acts that belong to the same kind or type, but they don't have the same type of object. In fact, sometimes one has an object and one doesn't have an object at all. And this amounts, in my opinion, to a kind of adverbialism about intentionality. I'll explain what that means. These are Ducasse and Chisholm, two philosophers who developed an adverbialist account of perception in the 40s and 50s at Brown University. And their view was that when you look at statements about perception, like you perceive red, those suggest one kind of metaphysics of perception. But they, in fact, can be paraphrased into other statements which suggest a completely different metaphysics but are logically equivalent. So you perceive red suggests that you have two particulars, you and red, and there's a perceiving relation that obtains between the two of you. So that's this metaphysical structure of the state of affairs described or reported in this statement. You have two particulars and a relation between them. They suggest what the real structure, metaphysical structure of the state of affairs is, would be better captured with something that sounds odd in English, but is logically equivalent, which is to say you perceive redly. Where here you have only one particular, you. The particular has a property, perceiving, a first-order property, non-relational property, and the perceiving itself has a property, some kind of intrinsic modification of the perceiving, which is redly. So redly will be a second-order property of you, a first-order property of the perceiving, and the perceiving is the first-order property of you. And all of these are non-relational properties. So the inspiration here is when you think about saying you walk slowly. When someone says you walk slowly, they don't mean that there is a relation between you and slowness, the walking relation. Rather, they mean that there is, you are engaged in a certain activity of walking, and there's a way in which you're performing the activity, the slow way. Slowly is how you are walking. Likewise, when you perceive redly, it's not like there's you and red and a relation between the two of you. Rather, there is, you are engaging in a certain activity, perceiving, and there's a way in which you're perceiving, the reddish way. What I'm suggesting is that we do that across the board for all intentionality, not just perceptual intentionality, but all intentionality. So instead of saying you think of dragons, we'll say you think dragon-wise. Again, this will be to say that it's not like there are two particulars, you and the set of dragons, and then there's a thinking of relation that holds between them, or that you bear to it. Rather, there is just you, the only particular here, thinking is a first order property that you have, and DragonWise is the way in which, so it's DragonWise is a second order property that you have. It's a property of the thinking. And more generally, I suggest perception, thinking, desiring, all the different kinds of intentional acts that you could have. Let's just summarize them with the term represent. Maybe not the most felicitous term, but we'll just use that. You represent dragons, in general, will be paraphrased into you represent dragon-wise. That's the adverbial theory. I'm not going to endorse this kind of theory, but I'll endorse a variation on it. Now, the question that arises immediately is, what does it mean to represent dragon-wise? I understand what it means to represent a dragon. I understand what it means to represent Luca. But what is it to represent Luca-wise? That's less obvious. So there are different variations on this, I think. One view you could have is inferentialist adverbialism. X represents dragon-wise if and only if X has a dragonesque inferential role. I should say maybe that X here ranges over states, representational states, not over creatures that can have representational states. So we can say both that thinkers represent dragon-wise and that thoughts represent dragon-wise. But it's more natural to say that thinkers represent a certain way because they have thoughts that represent a certain way. So the thoughts are the more basic kind of representation. So that's the kind of thing that X ranges over. X represents dragon-wise if and only if X has a dragonesque inferential role. There's a kind of inferential role and particular inferential role that you can specify, which we can call the dragonesque inferential role. And when you have that, then an item represents dragon-wise. Now this view, this is basically the kind of inferentialism you get in Brandom. An inferentialist theory of representation tells you that representation is not a matter of a relation to the world, it's a matter of the inferential role within the system of representations. So inasmuch as it says it's not a relation to the world, it's an adverbialist view. And the way that it unpacks the adverbial locution suggests this. Now, I think there is one very grave problem with this. This is not my own invention. A lot of people have discussed this. David Lewis discusses this as a problem for global descriptivism, and some cognitive scientists discuss it as a problem for functional role semantics or conceptual role semantics. It's what they call, at least, the grounding problem, the cognitive scientists. You have a web of items, and they get their representational character, or they fall under the intentional types that they do, in virtue of their relations to other items within the web. But in order for the representational character or the intentional type to be fixed, you really need that these other items will already have their representational character or intentional type fixed. Otherwise, you have a whole web of items waiting to get their intentional type fixed by having these other states of their items that they're related to fixed. And if you have a web where it's all kind of in a state of waiting, you could also have permutations that will not perturb the inferential role, but will perturb the representational character or the intentional type. Was that clear? I have a feeling that this was not clear. Maybe, how about this? You have a web of items. You need some items to fix their intentionality first, which intentional acts they are, before you can define the intentionality of other items in relation to them. Because if every item is getting its representational character or its intentional type fixed by relation to other items, then the whole web is never getting anything fixed. That wasn't much better, but I'll move ahead. Phenomenological adverbialism says that to represent dragon-wise is to have a dragonesque phenomenal character. Here, phenomenal character, I should say, is there are two notions of phenomenal character out there, I think. One is the notion of a sensuous quality, red, bitter, loud. These are phenomenal characters. Then there's another more flexible notion of phenomenal character is whatever we have an explanatory gap with, whatever produces an impression of an explanatory gap. Or we could define phenomenal character as the property F such that in the actual world there appears to be an explanatory gap between F and physical reality. This would be the rigidified definite description that fixes the reference of phenomenal. So it's this more flexible notion of phenomenal character that I'm using, and in that more flexible notion, there will be thoughts will probably have phenomenal character. So when you think dragon-wise, the claim here, it's because your thought has a phenomenal character, a draconesque phenomenal character. Here you still have a generalizing problem in the sense that a lot of representations just don't have phenomenal characters. Someone might have a tacit belief that 12.37 is greater than 8.92, and that's not going to have a phenomenal character. And linguistic representations certainly don't have phenomenal character. The word cat doesn't have a phenomenal, there's nothing it's like to be the word cat. What I suggest we do to overcome these kinds of problems with these versions of adverbialism is that we develop a variant on adverbialism which divides intentionality into two subgroups. There will be intentional states that are more basic, and they will get their intentionality either inferentially or phenomenologically. And then there will be other intentional acts that get their intentionality in relation to those first intentional acts. So the way I'm thinking of this is that we should distinguish between derived and underived intentionality and say that only underived intentionality is adverbial, and derived intentionality just derives from underived intentionality. So that's the idea. Underived intentionality is adverbial or non-relational, and derived intentionality derives from underived intentionality. So what's derived intentionality? Well, we all know that some things have their intentionality in and of themselves, and other things have it just due to convention or because we decide to give them a certain intentionality. A stop sign can mean stop, but it can also mean go, or it can mean you have just entered New York City. It can mean anything you want it to mean. But a thought about a cat means cats. Doesn't matter what you want to use it for. That's what it means. So words and stop signs don't have their intentionality in and of themselves, whereas thoughts and experiences do have their intentionality in and of themselves. Will that help? Yeah, it depends on how this all works out, but the general shape of the solution then, of the position, will be something like this. Underived dragon representations are dragon representations not in virtue of bearing their representation in relation to dragons, but in virtue of instantiating the non-relational property of representing dragon-wise. That's underived dragon representations. Derived dragon representations are dragon representations not in virtue of bearing their representation in relation to dragons, but in virtue of bearing the derivation relation to underived dragon representations. So in both cases, dragon representations are not the kind of representations they are in virtue of bearing a relation to dragons. Rather, there's something else happening. With the kind of basic representations, they will be adverbial. They are the representations they are in virtue of that adverbial property they have. With the underived representations, it will be because they derive from the underived ones. This is the general shape of the solution. How will this help with inferentialist adverbialism? I actually think it won't. This variant of inferentialist adverbialism will have to say that X non-derivatively represents dragon-wise if and only if X has a dragonesque inferential role, but you still have the grounding problem even within the web of non-derivative intentional items. With phenomenological adverbialism, you'll have to say X non-derivatively represents dragon-wise if and only if X has a dragon-esque phenomenal character, and that will help you with the generalizing problem under one condition, that the set of underived representations and the set of phenomenal representations are coextensive. If these are the same set, if all and only the underived representations are phenomenally conscious representations, then you can have this position will work. And I happen to endorse this thesis that only phenomenally conscious intentional acts have non-derivative intentionality. I've defended it in three different places, not just because they help you with this particular problem of avoiding ontological commitment to merely intentional object, but for other reasons. So if you combine this with the thesis that phenomenal intentionality is adverbial, you have this position that you can hold that dispenses with merely intentional objects. It says that phenomenal dragon representations are dragon representations not in virtue of bearing the representation relation to dragons, but in virtue of instantiating the non-relational property of representing dragon-wise construed as a phenomenal property. And then non-phenomenal dragon representations are dragon representations not in virtue of bearing the representation relation to dragons, but in virtue of bearing the derivation relation to phenomenal dragon representations. That's a general shape of the position on intentionality that I do endorse. It's a kind of a variant on adverbialism. And that, if this is your view of intentionality, you don't have to sign up on merely intentional objects. Because in neither case, both the phenomenal and non-phenomenal representations, there's no relation to what is putatively being represented. So that's a positive position, a kind of variant on adverbialism that dispenses with merely intentional objects. Now I'll consider five. How much time do I have?
Well, my watch isn't very reliable today, but I think you've been talking for about half an hour.
Half an hour, good. That sounds good.
Oh,
40
minutes.
35, let's split the difference. So I have at least 10 minutes. So now, I'll consider five objections to this position about intentionality, the position that helps us avoid ontological commitment to merely intentional objects, and claim that none of the, well, I'll claim that 4.5 of these five objections won't work. So the objections are, first I'll consider a cute little objection. I don't have a better name for it. Then there's an objection that says adverbialism and intention about adverbialism and intentional compositionality. Then one about the fact that we quantify over intentional objects, even merely intentional objects. And one that says, what about the view that intentionality is a relation to a content rather than an object? And finally, what are we going to do with the facts of the rare intentionality? So the cute little objection says something like, I call it that because I don't think it's a deep objection. It's kind of a clever and cute little objection. So it says, when you say something like Jimmy is thinking quickly, seriously, and you say that in adverbialese, that might mean any number of things. Well, not any, it mean at least four different things, but here are two things it might mean. Jimmy is thinking in a quick way about seriousness, and Jimmy is thinking about quickness in a serious way. These are two different things that could be meant in adverbialese when you say Jimmy is thinking quickly, seriously. And that's supposed to be a problem for the view. I think it's a superficial problem. All it means is that in adverbialese there will be certain ambiguities. Just like in English, the word bank is ambiguous as between financial institution and side of the river. So the word quickly in adverbialese will be ambiguous as between is done in a quick way and is about quickness. So we could distinguish quickly one and quickly two, just like we could distinguish bank one and bank two and fix the whole problem. Quickly one will be quickly that can be paraphrased into about quickness, and quickly two will be quickly that cannot be paraphrased into about quickness. And then we can say what we want to say without ambiguity. But the important point is that we can distinguish two different states of affairs, even though the way we would report it in naive adverbialese would be ambiguous. Now, the second objection about compositionality. That's an objection due to Frank Jackson. Maybe I should say another thing about this here. Nobody takes seriously adverbialism about perception, right? So how come I waltz in here and say, forget adverbialism about perception, be adverbialism about all of intentionality, not just perception? If we didn't take seriously adverbialism about perception, why would we take seriously adverbialism about something even wider? So there are two reasons, I think, why adverbialism about perception is not taken seriously. One is deep and one is technical. They're both deep in some sense, but one is non-technical and one is technical. The non-technical reason is that people said, yeah, but perception is really intentional. These guys, Chisholm, etc., they're telling you that when you perceive in a certain way. But no, perception is intentional. It has content. It's about something. I want to say, look, that's true, but intentionality itself is adverbial. So I can preserve the idea that perception is intentional. With Chisholm and Dukas, it seemed like in embracing an adverbialism about perception, they deny that perception was constitutively intentional, necessarily intentional. I'm not denying that because I'm going adverbialist about intentionality itself. So the non-technical reason to reject adverbialism about perception will not carry over to adverbialism about intentionality. Now, there's a more technical reason that nobody takes it seriously, which is that Frank Jackson produced what is considered to be a very good objection to adverbialism about perception. And I kind of don't buy that objection, but as a friend of mine would say, Frank Jackson is a genius and I'm an idiot, so I must be missing something. So tell me what I'm missing at the end of the talk or whenever you feel like it. The objection says something like this. Okay, you perceive a purple circle and a blue square. And the adverbialist tells you that the way you should report this is to say that you perceive bluely and purpley and circularly and rectangularly. But that won't distinguish this situation from the situation where the colors are flipped, right? Did you get that? This situation where you perceive a blue circle and a purple square. So what's an adverbialist gal to do? What you want to do here is really to change your paraphrase into something like this. You perceive blue circularly and purple rectangularly. Now you're treating blue circularly and purple rectangularly as syntactically simple expressions, predicates that cannot be broken into or decomposed into different items. And that will capture, there's a difference between you perceive blue circularly and purple rectangularly and you perceive blue rectangularly and purple circularly. That's a difference. So what's the problem here? Frank Jackson tells you that if you would do that, then you'll have no, you wouldn't be able to perform certain inferences that we perform all the time and that we regard to be perfectly acceptable inferences. For example, you couldn't say you perceive a blue rectangle, therefore you perceive a rectangle. That's something you can say in English, and that's a fine inference in English. What about in adverbialese? You say you perceive blue rectangularly, therefore you perceive rectangularly. That's invalid. That's like saying you perceive a pineapple, therefore you perceive an apple. It's to confuse a morphological part of a predicate for a syntactic part of the predicate. But what I want to say is that really there's two ways you can get from you perceive blue rectangularly to you perceive rectangularly, and one of them is invalid, but another might be valid. So here's what you cannot do. I agree you cannot do this. You cannot say you perceive blue rectangularly, therefore you perceive bluely, and you perceive rectangularly, therefore you perceive rectangularly. That's invalid because you can't go from one to two. But that's just like saying X is a strawberry, therefore X is straw and X is a straw and X is a berry, therefore X is a berry. That's the same kind of fallacy. And yet, this is perfectly valid, right? X is a strawberry, therefore X is a berry is a fine inference. So how does it work? Well, it's just the form of inference is of a different kind. It's something like X is a strawberry, being a berry is a determinable of which being a strawberry is a determinate, therefore X is a berry. What I suggest we do is to say the same thing about perception. You perceive blue rectangularly, perceiving rectangularly is a determinable of which perceiving blue rectangularly is a determinate, therefore you perceive rectangularly. So I should say you can get from 1 to 3, it's just you can get there in one way but not in another way. Maybe I'm missing something about Frank Jackson. Tell me what it is. Okay, next objection. We quantify over intentionalia. That's a clever word for intentional objects or mere intentional objects. So we say things like, the dragon I dreamt of last night was yellow. The table I am hallucinating right now is brown. The apple I'm visualizing right now is prettier than the peach I visualized yesterday. All these are things that we say. We quantify over these merely intentional objects, hallucinata and visualizata, if that's a word. I don't think it is, but so what? How can we get around saying such a thing and still say everything that's true? Because these things are true. Well, I suggest we go fictionalist. In fictionalism, we say, well, all this is sure. When you say Sherlock Holmes is a detective, that's short for, in the stories, in Conan Doyle's stories, Sherlock Holmes is a detective. And the fictionalist operator in the Conan Doyle stories, it goes without saying, literally goes without saying, right? Which is why we say the things that we do in everyday life. So we could also say, likewise, according to the story of my dream, the dragon was yellow. According to the story of my hallucination, the table is brown. There are prettiness degrees D and D star such that according to the story of my current visualization, the apple is pretty to degree D. And according to the story of my visualization yesterday, the peach is pretty to degree D star, and D is greater than D star. That's the paraphrase. Now you understand why we don't talk like this in everyday life. Why we resort to those easier, try to pick someone up with that sentence. So that's my response to the third objection. Fourth objection says that it's maybe better to think of intentionality as a relation to a content than a completely adverbial thing. The idea is that when you have a hallucination of a tree, it's not that there is a, an adverbial phenomenal character or something that makes it the case that a tree is what you're hallucinating. Rather, there is an entity called a content, and that you're related to that entity. You bear a relation to that content. I'm actually fine with this view, but I think we should not get confused on what the view is. Because the way people discuss intentional content nowadays, it's basically like they talk about intentional objects. We have to keep in mind that the only way this could be a response to the problems that we saw about hallucination, etc., is that if content is not what we think about. So people do say, when they discuss, let's say, within the literature on naturalizing intentionality, people say, well, there's a vehicle and there's a content. The vehicle is what does the representing, the content is what is being represented. That notion of content we cannot use here, because what is being represented, that's that lands you in the can of worms. It needs to be a view of content as this thing that is not what is being represented. Maybe it mediates the representation, but it's not what is being represented. It's not what we think about. So if it's not what we think about, then to bear a relation to a content, it might be fine that the view says that we bear a relation in an intentional act, we bear a relation to a content, But that relation is not the aboutness relation, because you're not thinking about the content. The content is not what is being thought about. In this, the relevant notion of content that we can resort to here. So what it turns out, I think, is that this is basically a third version of adverbialism. It's a version of adverbialism which says that X represents dragon-wise if and only if X is a dragon-esque content. Because what it says is that it's not like in representing a dragon, you are related to a dragon. No, you are related to something else, the thing that is not what you think about. You're related to a content. So you represent dragon-wise, but what makes you represent dragon-wise is that you're related to this other entity, the content. We can bring that out by considering this thought experiment about the avant-garde literary movement, which they're into the whole post-imperialist colonialism type thing. And they say, they are very upset with the tyranny of concrete particulars. Everybody is writing novels about concrete particulars. Sherlock Holmes, Cinderella, they're all concrete particulars. Why aren't we writing novels about abstracta? About abstract particulars, tropes, events? Why should we always write novels? Well, maybe events we do write about. Why shouldn't we write about abstracta? And so let's think of what kind of entity a content is. Most people will tell you, what is the content of a thought about Sherlock Holmes? It's probably an abstract entity which consists of a cluster of universals, all the properties associated with Sherlock Holmes in the story. That's the content of a Sherlock Holmes thought. It's an abstract entity, a cluster of universals. Now, these people, this guy, Shmonen Doyle, I guess we can call him, writes a story about this cluster of universals. He writes a story that there's a cluster of universals, and it's related to other universals in all kinds of ways, and that's the story. It's a very nice story. It's very suspenseful. You're very pleased with it. But it's not about Sherlock Holmes. It's about some other kind. The whole idea was that we don't want to write about concrete particulars. We'll write about these other things. So that's clear that these contents are not what we're thinking about. So there is still a question. I said why I prefer phenomenological adverbialism over inferentialist adverbialism. And I guess here we have what I'm claiming is that the idea that intentionality is a relation to a content is not a competition to adverbialism, because it is a version of adverbialism. But it will be a competition to phenomenological adverbialism. Why do I prefer phenomenological adverbialism? It's a big story, but basically there's a kind of Euthyphro dilemma that we can think of. Suppose I agree for the present purposes that an experience of a tree both has a treeish phenomenal character and is related to a content, which is maybe the property of being a tree. Now the question is it related to the content in virtue of having its phenomenal character, or does it have its phenomenal character in virtue of being related to the content? And that's, of course, its huge issue. But it just happens to be that my view is that you're related to the content, the experience is related to the content because it has its phenomenal character and not the other way around. So you have the experience here and it has its phenomenal character here, and then there are these entities all the way out there, abstracta, certain abstracta. I think it's weird to say that first you are connected, first the experience connects to the abstracta, and because it connects to the abstracta, it gets to have its phenomenal character. Makes more sense that it gets to have its phenomenal character and that makes it connect to the abstracta. I'm using temporal language as a metaphor, right? Temporal priority as a metaphor for logical priority. So that's why I prefer, that's the roughest sketch of why I prefer phenomenological adverbialism over content adverbialism, but for the purposes of the talk, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, some adverbialism is all I need. to avoid commitment to merely intentional objects. And the last objection is that there are all the problems of the re-intentionality, how we connect to actual things in the world, if representation is this adverbial thing, if it's not a matter of being related to the world, how do we connect to the world? You have the whole specter of a corrosive skepticism looming there. And it will find expression in more technical issues when we discuss the re-intentionality, so the intentionality that connects to particulars in the world. I want to say a couple of things about this. First, I don't deny that there is a representation relation. Many representations do bear a representation relation to something in the world, namely the veridical ones. What I'm claiming is that it's not universal and therefore not constitutive of representations that they do. Most representations, if we're lucky, do have a representation relation, do bear a representation relation to the world, but some don't. So it cannot be a requirement on being a representation that you bear a representation relation to the world. So what I want to say is that there is a representation relation, but it's involved in intentionality only contingently. So that's one thing. So that we do connect to the world, but only in the veridical cases. I think that's just all we really want to say. Now, about more specifically the Deray problems, this is the most difficult. I have to think a whole lot more about this, how to deal with this issue of Deray intentionality in an adverbial account of intentionality. So in the Deray intentionality, you don't think that Jimmy is cool, you think of Jimmy that he's cool. So you're related to Jimmy, the thinking of relation, and you think that he's cool. Well, that's a difference there in the logical form of the report. You don't think that Jimmy is cool, you think of Jimmy that he's cool. Some people claim that you can reduce the Ray intentionality to the dicto intentionality. Ernest Sosa holds that. I don't know what the argument is, but I need to get my act together and read it and figure out if I agree. Another idea that I had was to deny that the Ray intentionality is a real kind of intentionality, claiming that it's a rubber duck. Just like a rubber duck is not really a kind of duck, the Ray intentionality is not really a kind of intentionality. Why say that? Mainly because I think the definitive properties of intentionality, the definitive characteristics of intentionality, are not featured, not exhibited by the Ray intentionality. So what are the definitive characteristics? That reports of intentionality will A, fail existential generalization, and B, fail truth-preserving substitution of coreferential terms. So for example, when I say, I think that Jimmy is cool, it doesn't follow that there is someone such that I think that they're cool. And it also doesn't follow that, suppose Jimmy is Johnny's best friend. If I think that Jimmy is cool, it doesn't follow that I think that Johnny's best friend is cool. But when I think of Jimmy that he's cool, it does follow that there is someone such that I think of them that they're cool. And it also does follow that I think of Johnny's best friend that he's cool. So these definitive characteristics of intentionality will just not be exhibited by reports of their intentionality. So maybe their intentionality is not really a kind of intentionality. That seems a bit like a crazy view somehow, but like I said, I need to think about it much more. In conclusion, what I want to say is that we can avoid ontological commitment to merely intentional objects if we hold two things. One, that all intentionality derives from phenomenal intentionality, and two, that phenomenal intentionality is adverbial. If we hold these two things, then we don't have to commit ontologically to merely intentional objects. And that means that the fun is still on. We can still debate mathematical entities and time and et cetera. It hasn't been already settled that they all exist. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Now, let's see. I've got Michalis first. If the rest of you could just keep your hands up for a moment, please. Michalis first.
I have a question about your Basilian about content. So he thought that the content was a structured sort of object proposition, and it actually contained objects. That's no form of adverbialism, I say. So I think you spoke far too quickly there, and you should say it's consistent with, but it certainly doesn't entail adverbialism.
Okay, so what I want to say is that there are two notions of content there. One notion that this person can resort to, and one that they cannot. They cannot because then they will land in the can of worms that I'm trying to extract us from. So all this is within the under the assumption. This is all under the all this discussion is happening under the assumption that we don't want the can of worms. The Russellian notion of a content is precisely the notion of the content that I think they cannot resort to, because that is the kind of notion that will land you with the can of worms. It's a notion in the Russellian notion is that is what you're thinking about. The content of your thought is what you're thinking about. In that sense, content is just like an object. So when you use a notion of content that is not like object, then the Russellian view of content in that sense is not on the cards.
Okay. So
in the cards.
Let me just then repeat and see whether you agree with me then. The dialectical situation was you had a challenge from those who thought intentionality was a relation to content. Your rejoinder to that objection, remember this is that was supposed to be an objection, was, oh no, but don't you see intentionality as a relation to content is a form of adverbialism. Now I'm saying to you, false. What you say is actually false. In the dialectical context, you cannot get away with saying that. What you've got to do is not say, oh, we're trying to avoid the can of worms. What you've got to say is, oh no, of the various ways you can think of intentionality as a relation to content, there are some ways in which are consistent with my favorite my adverbialism that I'm trying to endorse. But the rejoinder you gave wasn't that. Rather it was, oh, that sort of response is a form of adverbialism. And that's why I say that was too strong a claim.
I'll have to contemplate some of this to see if this is how I was thinking of it. But yeah, let's just go. Suppose there isn't any talk here, and someone comes, rolls in, and says, intentionality is a relation to a content. I will say to them, look, I might agree with you, and I might not agree with you, like Michele says. I will agree with you if you use a notion of content that is not the same as the notion of an object. It's not what you're thinking about. If you use that, then I'll agree with you, and I'll also say that you're in the same family of views as my view, as it happens, but a different variant. If you say content is something else, content is what you think about, then I have to disagree with you.
It doesn't help, because if your object is a proposition, right, and the proposition can be Huey's standing, let's say, then it just doesn't answer the question. So what you're thinking about, the object that we're talking about, the intentional object, is Q, right? And that's what you want to get away from.
No. The intentional object is the proposition.
Well, intentionality can... Intentionality.
The way I use intentional object.
Well, it can be a relation to a content. But then when we talk about the intentional object of that thought is Q. And there is also the proposition.
No, I confuse things here in not getting clear on this. By intentional object, I don't mean object that is like an individual object. It's whatever is thought about. If what is thought about is a proposition or a property, then those will count as intentional objects. Properties, for example, will be intentional objects.
Propositions could be intentional objects too. But in the debate that you're engaged in, it's it's not about whether propositions are eliminable or any of that. It's mm-hmm. about whether
it is because propositions will be thinkables.
Now I've got a very long okay. list of people here.
I should just say that this will take 7 seconds. All I want to say is that the whole issue is whether thinkables exist or not.
I agree. Merely thinkables.
Right, mere thinkables.
I'm wondering whether your position can actually capture the white aspects of meaning. So let's take Tunaska, right? So if I tell you that Tunaska is thinking about water, you say, well, that's false. But is he thinking water wise or waterly? Well, it seems that he could be, right? So you got true for that one, whereas the original sentence would be false. And so it seems that some white aspect of meaning is lacking.
Cool. So there's a couple of things I want to say about this. First, I think this will, in general, be in the same ballpark as the deranged intentionality issue. But more specifically, there is a hidden agenda behind all of this, which is to push a strongly internalist view of intentionality. I actually deny that intentional states have a wide content. Well, I agree that there is a property of being related to these things, but I don't think it's an intentional property. So I think wide content is not real content. Yeah. Personally, I never got the Putnam and Burge intuitions that I was supposed to get. I don't think that what Oscar and Tosker are thinking about are different things. I think that XYZ is actually water. My view is that XYZ is water. It's just water is multiply realizable. And H2O is not identical to water. It's only constitutes its material constitution of, as Mark Johnston maintains.
So you don't get the intuition that when I say to you, well, Tunaska, so of course, against the background of the story, that Tunaska is thinking about water. Something odd.
Not at all. I'm not at all getting that. There is a variant on this, which I do get. When you say Oscar is thinking about his mother, twin Oscar is thinking about his mother, they're not thinking about the same thing. So in the case of singular intentionality, I definitely get the kind of intuitions that I'm supposed to get in the case of natural kind intentionality. But singular intentionality is the rare intentionality. Yeah, I'm not sure what to say about that, but I need to figure it out. But I think in that ballpark that you're pointing to are the deepest challenges to an adverbial account of intentionality.
Clarification on how the fictionalism sits with the rest of the story. So can you just perhaps go back to the slide where you had the fictionalist response?
Uh-huh. What's this around here? No.
Violent than Krishna.
So that sounds to me like an objection to fictionalism in general. How will fictionalism deal with the apparent quantification over fictional entities when there are these difficult cases of cross-fiction comparisons and comparisons between fiction and nonfiction? So let's see, when you say Thor is more violent than Uriah, I would have to, the paraphrase would be probably something like, in the Thor story, I have no idea what you're referring to actually. Who is this Thor?
Norse god.
Right. So in the relevant fiction, yeah, Thor is violent. Well, maybe I should say it the other way around. Uriah is violent to degree D. And in the relevant fiction, Thor is violent to degree D star. And D is smaller than D star. That's the paraphrase I would give to this one. It may be that it's problematic. I'm not well-versed in that particular literature, but that's what comes to mind immediately.
That's going to commit you to something like degrees now, and it pushes the lumps elsewhere. That's what I took to be the problem with these sorts of approaches. You get away from commitments to the fictional entities, but now you're committed to degrees.
Interesting. So suppose I say, in the what's the degree fiction? The mathematics. That's the in the fiction of math, there are degrees D star and D. And Uriah is violent to degree D, and in the fiction or the Thor fiction, Thor is violent to degree D star, and D is smaller than D star. I don't know. Is that? Yes. So that particular issue I actually did think about. This is a case where you're referring to fictional characters in a literary context, the context of literary criticism. You say something like, just like what you said, Sherlock Holmes was created by Conan Doyle. It's not like any fiction he was created in, it really was created. What I want to say about this is that Sherlock Holmes is actually an ambiguous term. It's a term for I like to distinguish fictional individuals from fictional characters. Fictional individuals are the things that the story is about. A fictional character is a literary entity, which is actually an abstract entity and actually does exist unless you have issues with abstracta. Notice that there are certain category mistakes that you could say. Or maybe category mistakes that that don't occur but would occur if we didn't make this distinction. So we say about Sherlock Holmes that he was a detective and that he was smarter than Watson, and that's within the fiction. We also say about Sherlock Holmes that he was a very fleshed out character, whereas Watson was a pretty flat character. Now that's, I think we're not talking about the same thing. It's not that the detective was fleshed out. What does it mean for a detective to be fleshed out? And the assistant of the detective is not flat. Was very horizontal kind of assistant. Vertical, I mean. Right, he was a vertical and not a horizontal assistant. So I think actually that kind of That kind of objection to fictionalism completely rests on a mistake, on the mistake being not recognizing that these terms are actually ambiguous. There are other responses to these particular problems with fictionalism. Stuart Brock has a clever response where he says, in the fiction of the realist view of fictional characters, blah, blah, blah. And then you can say everything you want to say, and it works. But I don't buy that, because I think he's responding to a pseudo-problem.
So if you, I like that response, obviously.
Mine or his?
No, it's yours, not
thank you.
But if you do that, then you do want to say there's a sense in which there are fictional characters.
Yes.
So why not also allow that there are these merely intentional objects, which distinguish intentional objects and intention, as well as intentional characters, if you like.
What I want to say is that these fictional characters, these literary entities, construed as something different from fictional individuals, they exist as far as the issues about fictional individuals are concerned. There might be other reasons. If you're a nominalist who rejects the existence of any abstracta, independently of the fact that you're also unhappy with merely intentional objects, then you will reject both the existence of fictional individuals and fictional characters. So I think it's just an open issue. The putative entity here is different. That's all I want to say. There are different issues about whether you should accept either of these putative entities. As it happens, I actually don't agree that there are fictional characters. But I think if there were fictional characters, that wouldn't make the number three exist. That wouldn't settle anything about mathematical entities, because that's a different kind of abstract entity. You seem puzzled. Okay. Okay, so this is something, there are two things I want to say about this. A cute little thing in the actual response. Maybe I should just say the response. In the paper in which I defend an adverbial view, this is not this paper, but another paper, it defends the adverbial view of intentionality, I discuss a little bit what's the purpose of paraphrase. What are we doing when we're doing a paraphrase, and the methodological issues there. The way I see it, a paraphrase doesn't settle any issues. We can imagine a world where people just speak. They say, I perceived redly yesterday, and I was thinking dragon-wise today, and that's just how they speak. And an adverbial theory of intentionality is kind of suggested by the way everybody speaks. And then comes the clever philosopher who says, but wait a second, there's a paraphrase. Maybe it's actually a relational, deep down it's a relational phenomenon. and it will get us all these other excellent features. Maybe it will land us in a can of worms, but otherwise it's pretty good. So the paraphrase just so shows equivalence between two things, but the fact that you can produce a paraphrase, and the paraphrase is inferentially integrated in the sense that it has all the same inferential connections as the paraphrasee, shows that the alternative metaphysics is intelligible, is viable. Now you have two competing metaphysics. Each of them is viable and intelligible. And now you have to have substantive arguments as to which one you actually want to go with. In the case of perception and intentionality across the board, I want to say there is reason to go with the non-relational account of intentionality because it will get you out of the can of worms of figuring out what merely intentional objects are. In other cases, you might say, but wait a second, here I prefer not to go with the paraphrase and stick with the paraphrasee because it has more advantages. You seem unhappy.
Richard.
So I wanted to try pressing Jackson's objection.
Yes, thank you.
I can't claim to speak for Jackson, but it seems to me that go back down three slides down on. So just the next one down, I think. Pigo.
That can't be it.
Yeah, well, next one, that's the one. To get around the problem, you threw in this extra premise two. Perceiving rectangle is a determinable blah blah blah. And here's my worry. Well, I guess there are two worries. First of all, when you make this inference, it doesn't feel like you're appealing to some extra premise like this two. So it just seems we go straight from seeing the blue rectangle to saying, oh, that's a rectangle, without appealing to some knowledge we have about rectangularness. So that's just the way it feels. Perhaps a deeper worry I have is that it seems we're going to have a lot of knowledge of this kind of sort that you've thrown in here about these properties, blue rectangularness, is a determinable of blueness and bluish, however it is. And it seems there's a hell of a lot of this knowledge, and the worry is, where do we get this knowledge from? It's not just sort of breaking down conjunctions of predicates or something. Where does it come from?
Let me address the first question first, because I actually thought about it. I think, I'm not sure it's right that it feels like the inference is direct, and I'm also not sure that it matters, it would matter if it did. So for the first part of this, consider when you say it's scarlet, therefore it's red. Does it feel like you're going straight from scarlet to red? Yeah, I think it feels like you're going through something like what is scarlet is also red. I put it in a more explicit way that makes it sound like a very sophisticated piece of information, that there's a determinable and determinate, but really that's what we think about it. What's scarlet is also red. Whatever is scarlet is also red. And that's to say that red is a determinable of which scarlet is a determinant. I think it's very natural to say that maybe the same kind of inference feels the same here. Yeah. We perceive a blue rectangle. What is a blue rectangle? Is blue. Therefore, we perceive a blue. So that's about the first. That's what I feel like saying about the first thing. And there is also the issue of whether it would matter, and that again is what the paraphrase is supposed to do. It's as long as all the inferential connections are related, I'm not sure that the paraphrase is supposed to capture the phenomenology that goes with performing inferences. Now, about the second bit about knowledge of principles of this form, you're claiming that this is, might turn out to be too sophisticated a kind of knowledge to attribute it to everybody who can make those kinds of inferences. I realize this, that, yeah, it might turn out to be like that. So what I need to argue is that it doesn't. It doesn't turn out to be. I think this is a commitment that I've incurred to show that the kind of knowledge that's captured in those kinds of principles about determinables and determinants is not knowledge that's too highfalutin to expect anyone who can make those inferences to have. I think this is something that we incur. And I haven't relieved my burden here.
Okay, next question. The person next to Amy, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name.
I have a question or a suggestion about Abergianism. So you rejected inferential Abergianism on the grounds that it can't face the generalizing problem, and then you went on to... the grounding problem, and then you went on to logical Abergianism. And I didn't find your solution to the generalizing problem for logical Abergianism convincing, but there's a quite elegant solution to the grounding problem for inferential Abergianism, which is that... the more sort of newfangled versions of inferentialism say that they're not just these relations between concepts and representation, inferential relations between concepts and representations. They're also, what some sometimes call language entry and language exit moves, perceptions and actions, and those are the things that ground the inferential network. Now, if you accept that, then you can combine the virtues of inferential Abergianism and phonological Abergianism while avoiding the problems of both accounts, because you can say that the language entry moves have this kind of phonological character that gives you the phonological Abergianism and the phonological aspect of the Abergianism while avoiding the grounding problem.
Right. Well, I think this is actually phenomenological adverbialism. Yeah, we're saying something needs to have something other than inferential role to get its representational character fixed, or to get fixed what type, what intentional type it belongs to. And we're saying, yes, there is something other than there is something other than inferential role, namely phenomenal character. Now, in fact, I think that's a phenomenological adverbialism. It will say these, you claim that these are just entry states, like input states and maybe output states. But I think it might be pervasive if we agree that there is a phenomenology of internal nodes. Yeah. But in any case, first, these will be the basic kind of intentionality. The let's say the input states, and all the other states derive their intentionality through inferential connections to the input states. That's a version of the variant on phenomenological adverbialism that I defended, where the derivation relation is based on inferential connections. And that's actually Brian Lohr's position, precisely that. The input states, perceptual states, have a phenomenology. They get they get typed intentionally on the basis of that, and everything else derives its intentionality from inferential connections to those input states.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's two notions of derived going on here, because you could say, well, phenomenologically, right, the input states are underlined. But you might want to say that semantically, the phonological states only have, well, you don't want to say content, but whatever it is you want to say, they only have their intentionality because of the inferential role they're in. Do you see what I mean? It seems like you could have a much more complex view that, at least I would find more attractive.
Sorry, so what's a more complex view?
Well, My suspicion is that in your response to my initial question, you were using derived in two different senses. One is semantically and one is logical. And it might be that the what I was calling the input moves are phonologically underived but semantically derived.
I was thinking that they are semantically underived, but they're semantically underived in virtue of having a phenomenology. So they have, or I should say, they have, they fall under underived intentional types in virtue of their phenomenology.
Yes, I mean, we're already over time, so yours is going to turn out to be the last question anyway, so if you'd like to just follow.
If you say that, then I'm not sure why you need the imperialism in the first place, because it seems the underived phenomenal states do so much work. Just by in virtue of being underived, they already have their, they already play their full semantic role.
No, they don't. They don't fall under any intentional types until they get inferentially integrated with states that already have their intentional type fixed. So just inferential role will never fix the intentional type, in my view, because of the grounding problem. You need something else. You need anchor points for the whole inferential web. What are the anchor points? One view is that the anchor points are phenomenally conscious states.
No, I understand that, but it seems that the anchor points are already doing all the work.
Yes, the anchor points are doing all the work,
right.
Yeah.
But then why do you need the rest?
Yeah, you mean, why do I need the rest? Well, I need to save the phenomena. The phenomena is that there is some intentionality which is not phenomenally conscious. I guess you could deny that. Galen Strawson denies that. But on the face of it, it seems like the tacit belief that 12.37 is greater than 8.92, I think that was my example, has intentionality, but doesn't have phenomenology. So how will we say that it has intentionality on this? Well, it's inferentially connected to, so that's why I need them.
Okay, well, apologies, there are several people who are still on the list, but we're out of time. There should be some coffee outside. One announcement before we finish. There'll be a dinner tonight, which will be at a very nice Indian restaurant down on Woolloomooloo Wharf. Some of you will know it already, because you've had conference dinners there in the past. It'll cost $45 for people with salaries, $25 for students. And if you'd like to come along, please let me know by lunchtime at the latest. That cost will cover the food, and then you'll be responsible for your own drinks. Okay, but now let's thank Uriah for a very rich